Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Numbers chapter 30, verses 1 through 16, a short chapter of this audio. We're going to discuss men and women's vows. This is a chapter of law. Our context is this: in Numbers chapter 29, we finished up with all the offerings that were required, how many animals and when, for burnt and sacrifice offerings for various festivals, namely the Feast of Trumpets, the Day of Atonement, and the Feast of Booths. So now we start with Numbers 30, verses 1 and 2. Then Moses spoke to the heads of the tribes of the sons of Israel, saying, "This is the word which the Lord has commanded. If a man makes a vow to the Lord, or takes an oath to bind himself with a binding obligation, he shall not violate his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth." Now Moses is speaking to the heads of the tribes. That could either be one head per tribe or multiple heads per tribe. We saw in the previous chapters in Numbers that the tribes did have one tribal leader, and he was named in some cases. I don't have the site in front of me, but I remember that. And so the heads of the tribes were a big deal. They were the chief honcho of the tribe. So I think it's probably talking about one leader per tribe, although the language would allow for two leaders per tribe. Now, if a man makes a vow to the Lord, the NIV Study Bible says that Numbers 30 is the principal Old Testament passage concerning vows. Adam Clark says there's several kind of vows that an Old Testament Jew could make. He could make a vow of abstinence or humiliation, as we'll see in verse 13. Of course, humiliation refers to fasting, so he could make a vow about fasting. "I'm going to fast for 3 days." Ooh, you better know what you're doing when you say that. Then there's the Nazarite vow, which we talked about in number 6, where you didn't drink wine and you didn't shave your head, special devotion to the Lord. And there was also giving certain things or sacrifices to the Lord. For example, the peace offerings, one of the peace offerings was a vow offering, which is, "If we win the battle, I vow to you, Lord, that I will sacrifice a ram to you," for example. Also, as Clark says, there could be a vow of alms given to the poor. "I vow I will give a certain amount of alms to the poor." So it's all kind of vows. Now, verse 2 just says very simply, a man shall not violate his word. Now, there are going to be some exceptions, but this idea of not violating a vow in general is a very important principle even today. You make a contract, you're supposed to enforce it. You're supposed to perform it. And if you don't, you can be liable at law. It's a big deal. Say what you mean and mean what you say. I mean, even in common morality, people hate being lied to, hate being told, "Hey, I'll pay you back," and then you don't get paid back. Let's read Ecclesiastes 5, verses 4 through 6. "When you make a vow to God, do not be late in paying it, for he takes no delight in fools." So there, the Bible says that if you don't pay your vows, you're a fool. "Pay what you vow," says the book of Ecclesiastes, verse 5. "It is better that you should not vow than that you should vow and not pay." Well, that's obvious. "Do not let your speech cause you to sin, and do not say in the presence of the messenger of God that it was a mistake." "Oh, yeah, I promised to pay you, but I really didn't mean it. That was a mistake. I really didn't have the money." Ecclesiastes continues, "Why should God be angry on account of your voice and destroy the work of your hands?" Oh, not only are you a fool, but God's going to destroy what you do because you don't keep your promises. Now, I said this, the general rule, that a man should not violate his oath, but there is, in this chapter, an escape for rash vow. So we need to distinguish between a rash vow, that's a stupid vow, and a non-rash vow, I guess we'll call it. A rash vow is when somebody gets excited. "Oh, I love you, I love you, I love you, I'll marry you next week, and I'll stay faithful for the rest of my life." That's a rash vow. You don't vow that to somebody, to some woman you've known for a week. You get overly stimulated by the smell of her perfume and the length of her fluttering eyelashes. No, that's a rash vow. Here's what Jameson Foster and Brown says about this, quote, "But as it would frequently happen that parties would vow to do things which were neither good in themselves nor in their power to perform," that's a rash vow, "the law ordained that their natural superiors should have the right of judging as to the propriety of those vows, with discretionary power to sanction or interdict their fulfillment. Parents were to determine in the case of their children, and husbands in that of their wives. Being, however, allowed only a day for deliberation after the matter became known to them, and their judgment, if unfavorable, released the devotee from all obligation." Well, that's just a very elegant way of saying what I'm going to tell you right here as we go through the book of Numbers 30, and we'll take up now verses 3 through 5. Also, if a woman makes a vow to the Lord and binds herself by an obligation in her father's house in her youth, and her father hears her vow and her obligation by which she has bound herself, and her father says nothing to her, then all her vows shall stand, and every obligation by which she has bound herself shall stand. But if her father should forbid her on the day he hears of it, none of her vows or her obligations by which she has bound herself shall stand, and the Lord will forgive her because her father has forbidden her. It means forgive her, not for making the rash vow, but forgive her from the duty of fulfilling that vow. It's not like she sinned or anything, but that's sort of what it sounds like. I think that if we had a Noah translation, it comes out much better than the Holman Christian Study Bible. If her father prohibits her on the day he hears about of it, none of her vows and none of the obligations she put herself under are binding. The Lord will absolve her because her father has prohibited her. Absolve sounds a lot better than forgive. Forgive actually like it's a sin. It's like when we forgive a debt. We're not forgiving any sin on the part of the debtor. We're forgiving the debtor's obligation to pay. Now, this section concerns women making vows. Why? Well, why this law? The NIV Study Bible says the law was probably designed for the protection of the woman. I don't think there's any doubt about it. I don't know why they say probably. Women were socially weak and potentially subject to great societal pressures to make vows. And this law kept people from taking advantage of her. This is very similar to Western common law that allows contracts with minors to be voided. I used to teach that, teaching legal environment of business in college or contract law in college all the time. So it's a similar idea. We protect people who are not able to stand on their own two feet yet. Now, some rabbis included minor boys under this law also because it's the same idea, just like Western law. So the rabbinic law did the same thing, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says. Now, this is a woman who makes a vow in her youth, and that just assumes that she's still in her father's house and she hasn't gotten married yet, I think. There's no precise date on what the age of majority is. The rabbis said the age of majority for women was 12 and 13 for men. It's pretty young. So let's say you got a 13-year-old daughter in your father's house. She's able to stand on her own and her father can't disavow her vows. I don't think so. I just think it means as long as she's not married, the father can disavow her daughter's vow in order to keep her from having to pay a stupid vow, a rash vow that she might have made. An innocent vow sounds a little bit better than stupid. She doesn't know the ways of the world, and she makes an innocent vow that could hurt her, and her father can disavow it. Verse 5, the father should forbid her on the day he hears of it. He has one day. This gives a presumption that vows will be kept. You can't mess around. You can't hold the promisee of the vow in suspense as he wonders whether the vow will be carried out or not. So the father's got one day to protect his daughter. There's a dispute over what that one day is. Is it one day until sunset like a Jewish day, or is it 24 hours? The rabbis disputed that, but whatever. We'll have to leave that to the rabbis. So this one day, this short period of time, shows that the presumption of the law is in favor of forcing people to keep their vows. There's an escape hatch, but it's a narrow escape hatch. We go down to Numbers 30, verses 6 through 8. However, if she should marry while under her vows, before verse 5 was talking about when she was single, versus not just verse 5, but all of verses 3 through 5 was talking about if the woman was single. Now, if she should marry while betrothed, well, it's actually a little bit ambiguous about what this means. I've got to go through some options. But the idea is if she should marry, which is in apposition in verses 3 through 5 when she's single in her father's house. Now she is going to marry in verse 6 through 8. However, if she should marry while under her vows or the rash statement of her lips by which she has bound herself, and her husband hears of it and says nothing to her on the day he hears it, then her vows shall stand, and her obligations by which she has bound herself shall stand. But if on the day her husband hears of it he forbids her, then he shall annul her vow which she is under, and the rash statement of her lips by which she has bound herself, and the Lord will forgive her or absolve her from the vow. Now, I'm going to give you some options about which vows it is the woman is under. In verse 6, if she should marry while under her vows. That word vows is actually a little bit ambiguous because it says if she should marry while under her vows or the rash statement of her lips, We've got several options, and I'm going to go through them with you, but let's just remember one thing. All three of these options refer to vows made before the marriage, while she's still in her father's house. Now, option number one, what does that word vows mean if she should marry while under her vows? Well, you could take it to mean it refers to her marriage vows. If she should marry while under her marriage vows, in other words, we read it this way, she makes a vow before she's married. She's under her betrothal contract. She's under her marriage vow contract, and she makes a vow, and then she gets married. That's option number one. Now, this would mean, of course, that the betrothed woman would have her vows annulled by her father, not by her husband, assuming the father hears of it. But if he doesn't hear of it, once she gets married, once that betrothal contract is performed and the girl gets married, then the husband, if he hears of it, he's got a day to annul that vow if he so desires. Well, that makes sense. The problem, I think, with that is if you read this verse, if she should marry while under her vows, her marriage vows, very serious, or the rash statement of her lips, if she's under a serious marriage vow or a silly rash vow, it doesn't seem balanced around the disjunctive or. It doesn't seem balanced to put on the left side of the or a very serious marriage vow and on the right side of the or a silly, foolish, flippant, rash vow. So I don't really like that option very much. Here's option number two. However, if she should marry while under her vows, that means a reasonable vow, or, exclusive or, the rash statement of her lips. In other words, if she should get married while she's under a reasonable vow or a rash vow, either one doesn't matter. Assuming her father hasn't heard about it, she gets married, then her husband has the right to annul that, either that solid vow or that rash vow, if he does it within one day. That makes the or exclusive, a vow, a good vow, or a rash vow. So that would make any vow, reasonable or rash, voidable by the husband. And of course, this assumes that if a father hasn't avoided it already while she was betrothed before the marriage. Now, there's a third way you can take this vow. If she should marry while under her vows, if she's under a rash vow, so that would make under her rash vow or the rash statement of her lips, that would make the rash statement of her lips in apposition with the vow, just a repetition of the word. And so that would mean that the husband could annul a rash vow when he hears of it, assuming the father hasn't heard of it already, while they were betrothed. But the problem with that view is it means that the husband would not, it implies that the husband would not be able to annul a solid vow, a reasonable vow. And I don't believe that's true. I believe if a husband could annul any vow he wanted to, so I don't like option three. So it's either option one or two, if she should marry while under her marriage vows, although that does sound a little redundant. Option two is if she should marry while under her vows, reasonable vows or the rash statement of her lips. I think that's one I'm going to go with. But the point is, it doesn't really matter how you take it. Just basically to summarize all this confusing stuff is that if the woman is betrothed, her father can disannul her vows if he does it in a day. And if the woman makes a vow before she gets married while she is betrothed, the father can disavow it if he hears about it. But if he doesn't hear about it and she gets married, then the husband has the opportunity to disavow, but only if he does it within a day. Again, a day either meaning 24-hour day or till sundown, depending on how you interpret that day. We go now to Numbers 30, verse 9. But the vow of a widow or of a divorced woman, everything by which she has bound herself shall stand against her. Of course, stand against, that just means the vow has to be carried out. Once she's married and then her husband either dies or divorces her or she becomes divorced, she might divorce him. Vows are good. Now, this note that the power to annul the vow, to disavow the vow, it does not return to the father, the power to do this. It stays with a woman. As the NIV Study Bible says, she is her own agent in the taking of vows. Now, that's kind of interesting. That shows that in at least one case, a woman could have independent legal standing. People always talk about how the Old Testament law was so patriarchal. But here, a woman could stand on her own legal bottom, if you will. Let's read what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says about this. Quote, in the case of a married woman who, in the event of a separation from her husband or of his death, returned, as was not uncommon, to her father's house, a doubt might have been entertained whether she was not, as before, subject to paternal jurisdiction and obliged to act with the paternal consent. The law ordained that the vow was binding if it had been made in her husband's lifetime, and he, on being made aware of it, had not interposed his veto. So, in other words, the woman is bound to her vow, even though she's returned to her father's house, which was the custom. People might think, well, time for the father to exercise his paternal authority and protect her from rash vows. No, she could make the vow or not make the vow. She stuck on the vow. Now, this assumes two cases. One is the vow was made before she lost her husband by death or divorce, or she made the vow after she lost the husband by death or divorce. Either way, she's bound. As Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, if the vow was made before the husband dies or he was divorced, or she was divorced from him, if the vow was made before the separation from the husband, she is still under obligation. For example, she might make a pledge to charity, but, her husband dies. She's financially insecure, so she says, nope, I'm not going to make that vow anymore. I'm not going to give to the poor like I said I was going to. No, she is still under the vow. We go now to Numbers 30, verses 10 through 16, and we'll finish this chapter. However, if she vowed in her husband's house or bound herself by an obligation with an oath, and her husband heard it, but said nothing to her and did not forbid her, then all her vows shall stand, and every obligation by which she bound herself shall stand. In other words, this is just the idea the husband's got one day to disavow. If he doesn't, the vow stands. The woman is bound to her vow. Verse 12, Numbers 30. But if her husband indeed annuls them on the day he hears them, then whatever proceeds out of her lips concerning her vows or concerning the obligation of herself shall not stand. Her husband has annulled them, and the Lord will forgive her, i.e. absolve her. Every vow and every binding oath to humble herself, and that means to fast, her husband may confirm it or her husband may annul it. But if her husband indeed says nothing to her from day to day, then he confirms all her vows. In other words, if he doesn't say anything in one day, then silence is the same thing as saying, yes, I confirm your vow. If her husband says nothing to her from day to day, then he confirms all her vows or all her obligations which are on her. He has confirmed them because he said nothing to her on the day he heard them. But if he indeed annuls them after he has heard them, then he shall bear her guilt. Now, bear her guilt is the New American Standard Bible's way of saying, well, let me give you the Holman Christian Study Bible translation. But if he cancels them, the vows, after he hears about them, he will be responsible for her commitment. Now, isn't that a great translation? That just shows you how much better the Holman Christian Study Bible is, or the ESV is, than the NASB. There's no wonder that hardly anybody uses the NASB anymore. It is so wooden. It is so hard to understand sometimes. All right, so verse 16, these are the statutes which the Lord commanded Moses as between a man and his wife and as between a father and his daughter while she's in her youth in her father's house. So this chapter is actually not very hard to understand. The woman is protected by her father. When she gets married, she's protected by her husband. And after the husband dies or is divorced, then she stands on her own. I guess she knows enough of the world by now, having been married for a while, how to deal with people trying to make her make rash promises. Ladies and gentlemen, we are now finished with Numbers chapter 30. In our next audio, we will take up Numbers chapter 31, verses 1 through 54, Vengeance on Midian. I hope I can finish the 54 verses. I'm not sure I can, but we'll at least start. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.